Great. So thanks, Matt and the other organizers, for giving me the chance to making this happen. OK, good. So so first, I'm going to talk, and then Aaron. And we're organized by spin. So I'm going to talk about gauge fields, and he's going to make some remarks about gravity. OK. Oh, and I should have done this before. It's largely based on two papers. Whose content are significantly overlapping. This one is the short one, and this is the longer one.
Okay. Another paper on spin zero, actually.
Right, yeah. Good. OK, so what I want to talk about is some puzzles that come up when trying to talk about entanglement entropy in gauge theories. And in this talk, I'm just going to focus on the sort of simplest case of a U1 gauge theory and no matter, so good old-fashioned E&M. OK. And the three puzzles that I want to address. And so there are three puzzles that I want to address. Oh, and I should mention this is supposed to be a discussion, so feel free to interrupt. You know, these are my puzzles, but of course there are many, many more that may be worth discussing. OK. Right. And sort of the reason to focus on some of these issues actually was expressed rather eloquently, I think, by one of the organizers to me, who said, we've done enough calculating of entanglement entropy that now we can actually stand back and ask what we're calculating. So the first issue is has to do with factorization of the Hilbert space. So if you just have something like a spin model, and you want to divide it up, put some entangling surface that separates some set of spins from some other set of spins, then it's, you know, and you call one side A and one side B, then it's clear that you have a tensor product. Whereas in a gauge theory, we'd usually express that using a lattice where the degrees of freedom live on some edges. And so the Hilbert spaces are here, and they're tied together by constraints that act at the vertices. And so the physical Hilbert space, roughly speaking, is a tensor product of local things, some H associated to the edges, mod some gauge symmetry. And that's not a tensor product in any local way. Okay. And so the question is then, in this context, what is the entanglement entropy? What should we mean? Well, you know, what's the useful quantity to calculate? What should we mean? Okay. So for example, you know, you do Ryutake Nagi or something in n=4 super Yang mills, what are you actually calculating? And so we're going to ask the question of, okay, what are you calculating in this theory? Okay. Good. So that's one puzzle. If you're not worried about these sort of conceptual things, you might say, okay, we'll stop worrying and just use the replica trick. Good. So the puzzle there is that one can have these contact interactions. So if you consider the case where the entangling surface has a rotational symmetry about it. So, you know, this is like our Euclidean space-time. Our entangling surface is here. The way we could calculate it is by inserting some conical singularity of angled beta. And then we vary the partition function like this, which is the usual way that you would get entropy out of a partition function. And now the issue is that there's a curvature singularity in the manifold here. So there's a question of how that's treated. So, so in general, this partition function is going to look like some set of diagrams. So if my singularity is here, I have some set of diagrams that go around. And if you don't couple the curvature, this is the only class of diagrams that you have. If you have some singularity, then there's some other class of diagrams that interact with it. And so the question is what, so there's a piece of the entropy from here and a piece of the entropy from here. Okay. Now in the case of the gauge theory, the...
So when you say diagrams, yeah. You're imagining some Euclidean calculus.
That's right. This is the Euclidean, right. This is the Euclidean path in your
problem. Yeah, you're just doing the Euclidean path.
That's right. So the way that this works is you have this symmetry, right? So you use that to do a weight rotation, like in De Sitter or a short shot or whatever. You do this weight rotation, right? So you're in the Euclidean. You do the Euclidean path integral, but you change the period, the angular period around some point, and you introduce a singular.
But when you have a line that ends in the dot, you're imagining somehow there's some interaction in the Hamiltonian between degrees of freedom that live on the dot and ordinary fields.
So it'd be like a.
This is one class of diagram, right?
It's a curvature.
It'd be like a term like this.
That dot is. You mean.
This is the singularity. This is the conical singularity. It's this point here.
Are you imagining this U1 curvature as well there, or just is it like a flux at that point as well, or something?
No. This is space-time curvature. So you can show that for beta close to 2π, you can view this as a flat manifold that just has. Riemann tensor that has some to linear order in beta minus 2π just looks like a delta function on this surface. So I call this point sigma. It's a codimension 2 surface, and then there's some phi normal here. So it's not a that's right. It's not the gauge curvature. It's a space time curvature.
To do that for arbitrary beta, even for a free scalar field theory, you would actually have to specify a boundary, an asymptotic behavior of the fields as they approach the singularity, basically, and that would depend upon beta.
That's right. So there are various things that you could do.
You don't have to do that. You could smooth out the thing.
Well, if
for
you
example.
Want to calculate the propagator, yeah, that's what you would have to do. But yeah, you could. It's not clear that smoothing out the singularity on a scale larger than the cutoff is the same thing. But anyway.
No, that's good. So that's exactly the point that I'm trying to get at. There are a bunch of ways that you could imagine treating this. I mean, the simplest thing that you could imagine doing, maybe, is just putting like a, an Etouffed brick wall or something right here. And then you'd keep all of these and you'd lose these diagrams. Maybe you'd get something that, that interacted directly with the wall. It may depend on what boundary conditions you put there. So there's some, here it looked like, here it's sort of not clear what to do. And here there's some other choice of what to do.
Is that not related? That's not related to the fact that it's a gauge theory, though.
Mm-hmm. Not direct. No, not. No, it isn't. So you would get this for a non-minimally coupled scalar field, for example.
Or maybe even a minimally coupled one. Yeah. You're just making up the rules for what happens at that point, right?
So that's right. You could make up different rules for what's happening here. The question is, should you call that resulting thing entanglement entropy?
Right.
Because if you put your scalar field on a lattice, is there a sort of matching freedom here, or is there some particular thing that's selected? So, in the case of
black hole physics, smoothing out the tip seems to be a good answer.
That's the good thing.
It's a good thing that would give you like the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, entropy. But then if you put in the brick wall, again, non-minimally coupled scalar, you get something from that curvature. Mm-hmm. And if you put in the brick wall, you need some weird boundary condition.
The principle might be just you put whatever you need to put there to get.
That's one thing you can say.
I think a good answer is right. So your favorite thing to do might be to smooth out the singularity, and I think that is the right thing to do. But then you have to ask, okay, for that choice, what might that correspond to over here? In this case, you can actually answer that question.
Another question is whether it matters if whether these just change the non-universal terms.
Yeah. Good, I'm getting to that too. That's three. Good. Okay. All right. So excellent questions. And those, they're good because I actually know how to answer them. But it's coming. OK, good. Right. So what I wanted to say is that for the electromagnetic field, the operator that you're looking at, you know, whose determinant you're calculating here, is this one. I may have this sign wrong, but anyway. But the point is that it has some, it has an explicit Ricci tensor in it, and that's where this kind of diagram comes from in E&M. Okay, and if you evaluate this and put it into the entry formula, indeed you get two terms from these two classes of diagrams, and these were first done by Cavat. Let's see, about 20 years ago now. All right. And so you get d minus 2 times the entropy of a S scalar. Okay, that's good. That's the local bosonic degrees of freedom. And then from the second term, you get something that goes like minus the log of the partition function of a scalar in d minus 2 dimensions. Okay. So when first found this was somewhat disturbed. So what he calculated was only the sort of leading area law piece of this, using a heat kernel regulator. Yeah.
Why is it a free energy on that instead of an entropy? Do you mean S?
No, I don't mean that.
Okay.
It's okay. Good question. Yeah. Why? Who ordered this thing? So yes, it's very weird. The first thing that he pointed out, he calculated it to leading order using a heat kernel regulator. And in fact, this term dominates this one in dimensions less than 8. So in fact, the whole answer that he got was negative. And so he said, OK, well, we shouldn't interpret this term as any kind of entropy. It's just something else. I don't know, somehow that's not a very satisfying answer. So. So right, what is this thing? Okay.
Honestly, concealing that we're the ones who worked out the non-leading answer.
Right. So he worked out the leading order thing in this paper. Well, more really in the longer paper, we go and calculated this sort of subleading.
Was that
piece
done
of this.
In a particular gauge or what?
So it was in covariant gauge.
Covariant.
In fact, Feynman gauge. Right. So, let's see. You can try to do. So, if you do the calculation in a different gauge by using a. So, if you stay within the covariant gauges but change the Tuft parameter, then what you find is that if you just calculate this determinant, then you get a gauge dependent answer. But I think Solodukin a few years ago showed that you could adjust the cutoffs of the longitudinal and transverse pieces in a way that depends on that parameter to make the answer always be the same. Is that enough? So it sort of looked at first when you first look at this term, it looks like a non-gauge invariant thing. You can actually rewrite it. As a sort of walled entropy type of term, and it looks like the expectation value. So Aaron and I explained this in our paper. Do you remember the? There's like minus pi times this. I think
okay.
is this term integrated over the surface sigma. So it looks like a very non-gauge invariant thing, but so you might say let's just right. But it may have some, but this is only, this is just an expression in those gauges that may contain some, universal subleading piece. So you might think that because this is local, you can just throw it out, but, right, and only think about what's universal. So that's sort of that brings me to my third point. So you might think that this doesn't matter for, you might say, let's just only calculate the universal piece and not worry about the full thing. So the universal piece is a log divergence. So I'm going to focus now on 3 plus 1. Okay. So in 3 plus 1, you can consider the entanglement entropy for a sphere of radius r. Okay. And what that should look like is some number. There's some area law piece. There's some, and this subleading divergence, which is related to A, which is the coefficient of the A-type trace anomaly. This is shown by Cassini, Hirsch, and Myers. And then there's, some finite piece. Which is also important, but we're going to focus on this this universal bit. Okay, and now, so if you believe this, you the answer that the anomaly gives you for an electromagnetic field, you can just squiggle here is going to mean just the log term. You get a log term that's 31 over 45. But you could also you can also just calculate this in a number of ways. So this was first done by, I think, by Dauker, but the calculation has been repeated. And what they all found was a different answer. 45.
Do you want to call that a different thing?
Oh, yeah, sorry. That's not the right thing. So they did this by thermodynamics. So I'll call it S thermal. So, right. So the way that you... There are a couple ways that you can calculate this. Because you're in a CFT, you can map this either onto De Sitter space and calculate the De Sitter entropy. It's just the thermodynamic entropy in De Sitter space. Or you can also make a conformal transformation to H3 cross time, and then it's a thermal entropy in a hyperbolic space.
Okay. And that's the second one.
Yes, that's the second one, right? This is the calculation that you could do in DS or in
first one, and you just calculate A and plug it in.
And this is right. If you don't feel like calculating it, you look it up in Girl and Davies or something.
But A is some other method.
A is calculated by some method, and I think it's been probably calculated by many different methods. But yes, that's right.
The first thing
it's not calculated by this entropy.
First things when you get, you just did like a geometrical on a football thing, but using that form of the geometric formula for the entanglement.
Sure. You would you could get this anomaly result by doing this and smoothing this out a little bit.
Can't you also just do some heap kernel? I mean, there's like a billion ways.
No, exactly. This is a billion ways of this has been done. Yeah. But if you wanted to derive, the question was if you wanted to derive that the entropy has the same term in it, then the prescription that a prescription that would give that is to smooth out the singularity. Okay. Good. Okay, so now I'm going to talk a bit about how these are resolved. So in the case of U1. Okay, so the definition of entanglement entropy that I want to propose is the following. So you have a U1 theory. The degrees of freedom are some electric fields living on the links of your lattice. You cut it in some way into regions A and B. Okay, so your general state you can write in the electric field basis is a sum over all possible discrete electric fields, some amplitudes. And now for any set of electric fields, so first of all, I'm going to cut my lattice in this way so that it's separating the vertices into two sets and it's cutting through some set of links or some set of edges. Now, the issue now is that for each electric field here, it lives in both Hilbert spaces. So the way that I'm going to divide up the Hilbert space is for each electric field, I'm going to split it into a piece that lies entirely in A, some piece that I'm going to call E perpendicular, which is the, which are these ones here, the ones perpendicular to the boundary. E, EA are going to be all the ones that are sort of all in the interior of A, and EB are all over here.
So E represents the full electric field configuration everywhere?
Everywhere, yes. This E is everywhere. And then EA is the restriction of E to A. E perp is the restriction of E to this set of edges that intersect the surface. And then EB is the ones that live entirely within B.
Are the electric fields conserved?
Yes, that's right. No, that's a good that's a good point. So yes, these E's will all satisfy the discrete Gauss's law.
So the E perps depend on the EAs, then?
Pardon?
The E perps are determined once you know all the EAs, then.
That's right. They're also determined once you know all the EBs.
Yes.
So that's right. So you could sort of put your cut over here, like right at this edge, and say, aha, this edge only lives in here. But really, it actually lives in both, because you could calculate it once you know the other three. So there's a certain amount of fuzziness to this procedure because of the constraint. But yeah, it sort of doesn't matter that I put these, that I put this E-perp in both sides. It was sort of there already. Okay.
And you could also just erase it completely.
Yeah. That's right. I could erase it completely, but I want to. I don't want to do that. I want to keep track of it. So, right. So, if you like, I can choose to. I'd prefer to label my electric field by E perp and all the EAs except for one that's determined by E perp. I mean, right. These are not. The E's are never independently specifiable. So I'm just going to write down the whole list of them, which is overcomplete. But that's fine. They just all have to satisfy this constraint.
By erase it, you'd mean trace it out and then be left.
No, I mean, if I tell you all the EAs and all the EBs, you can go compute all the E perps. So in some sense, they're not independent labels. I would write this with EA, EB.
But the problem is that EA and EB are not independent.
Yeah,
so you would miss that information. No, they're not. They're joined by the E perps.
No, because the collection of three EAs is equal to a collection of three EBs because they're both equal to E perp.
Yeah, but if I don't tell you.
But you want to specify the E perps and then choose some set of EAs and EBs which is consistent with that somehow. Is that what you're trying to do?
Just enlarging the Hilbert space.
Yeah,
no, that's it.
Well,
you get some redundancy in his notation.
Yes, no,
it's just
he's
a notational thing.
At this point,
A not equal to
E. No, he hasn't done anything.
It's an overcomplication.
Daniel knows the next step. That's what he's saying. I haven't done it yet.
I just wrote down a formula.
So far, I just wrote down a formula. Right. But what I'm going to do now is I'm going to interpret this. I'm going to interpret this now as a state in a product Hilbert space. So that is in some sense adding new degrees of freedom. So I'm going to call this a state of A. The span of all these things. I'm going to call HA, and the span of all these things I'm going to call HB. And now it's true that although I have a way of expressing each psi inside the central product, it's basically an embedding. It's not a. So this is not equal. It's some subspace.
But doesn't the sum rule mean that the del dot equals zero mean that there I can choose a state in EA comma E perp that eliminates some states that you would otherwise put in EV?
Yeah, so I think what you're...
Which I would say is now not a tensor problem.
No, that's right. So what is this thing? This thing is the space of all states that have some... You can think of it as some electric field configuration here, some electric field configuration here, but right along here there's some E... You know, there's the E perp that came from A on this side, and there's the E perp that came from B on this side, and it doesn't satisfy Gauss's law anymore. So that's this description of state. But if you're within this space, then it's true. Once you've measured something in here, you learn something about it over there.
It's like putting infinitely massive charges, right, in the middle. At least when you expand the space.
I just want to make sure I
and
understand.
And then you restrict to zero charge.
So the HA cross HB include states that don't satisfy Gauss's law.
That's right. And you can then view this as the kernel of the Gauss's law constraint sitting inside here. So it's all the, so this is the, right. So H is this, maybe I could write out specific, you know, explicitly.
You still import
the span of all things of the form EA, E perp, you know, E, B, E perp, where these are the same, right, equal.
You still impose it almost everywhere.
You impose it almost everywhere. This is a sort of minimal breaking of gauge symmetry that allows you to talk about a product and an entropy. I should say this isn't the only the only definition of entropy for these theories before. So for those who are in Horacio Cassini's talk, he gave a series of definitions of that he proposed for entanglement entropy. I think that this is, so they don't agree. In fact, his definitions don't all agree with each other. There are a number of them. And I don't think, in general, I don't think any of them agree with this one, and I'm going to argue that this is the right one.
It's not the Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I thought it was the electric.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Something else you could have done would be to work in a magnetic field basis.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like momentum versus position or whatever, right? And then I could have just asked whether I have monopoles or not along the, or there would be some corresponding thing. Would that be different than this, or?
It's not clear to me why those should be the same. I don't yet know the answer to that. I mean, I don't see why those have to be the same, because if you wanted to transform from one set of variables to the other set of variables, from electric to magnetic potentials, you would have to do some non-local transformation. So you're mixing up the degrees of freedom across space, and I don't see why the entanglement, they're different, you're talking about a different set of degrees of freedom.
So this is some basis dependent, like you chose to work in some basis and then ignore Gauss's law, whereas I could have worked in a different basis and ignored a different law.
Well, it corresponds, I think, to a different way of organizing your degrees of freedom in space. It corresponds to a different choice of what is sort of measurable within some region, I think.
Once you have a lattice theory the way he's chosen it, you do have monopoles, but you don't have electric charges. So, so it's not symmetric already.
That's a good point. So maybe there is a dual description, but you'd have to do something different in the dual description.
Yeah, you're gonna have to do something, right? You're gonna have to break some law.
With a lattice theory, you don't have exact electric magnetic duality.
Sure, but presumably you're not gonna end up in some other description with a perfectly factorized Hilbert space, otherwise it probably wouldn't have arrived. So something else is gonna have to be done.
So this is my choice. This is my choice of entropy, but I'm going to relate it to these Euclidean things. So what I want to show is that this. So I haven't said what the entropy is, but maybe you guessed that already. So what you can do is you can take psi, right, and you can sort of embed it into HA tensor AB, and then you can calculate your entropy normally there. And when you do that,
that went by too fast. I don't understand how to calculate the entropy.
So this is a state. This is a state of a infinite dimensional Hilbert space.
Okay.
And you map it. So this is an element of this space via some via this inclusion.
Right, and now you're going to trace over what?
I'm going to trace over B and calculate the entropy of A. But, of course, as you know, I could have traced out A and I calculated it in B. But that's the quantity I'm going to consider. Okay. So when you do that something...
If you add to psi a state that doesn't satisfy the constraint, does it change the entropy? It would be a null state when you project out back to H.
Oh, I see. So you're saying, does it change
the entropy?
If you add, well, you want to change the state.
Yeah.
To something else that lives in here but not in here.
Yeah, so it would project out, if I were to say, the physical Hilbert spaces.
So yeah, I mean, you change the state, so you always get a different entropy.
Play. You could start with a random state, HA and HB, you could project it onto the state that's good, and calculate the entanglement entropy, or you could just calculate the entanglement of that. But I think the game we're playing here is just starting with a state that's good in this space from the beginning, and just asking what the entropy of that state is.
Okay, but you'd expect it to change a few.
Yeah, right.
I mean, one way to think about HA times HB is it's the Hilbert space of the gauge theory where you allow charges to sit along, arbitrary charges to sit on. So you just supplement your gauge theory with charges that happen to sit. Oh, but they're only allowed to sit on the entangling surface.
That's right. And if you were to sort of, you know, enlarge the region and look at that surface, they would have disappeared. You'd find that those charges that you put in were really just, you know, you had some description where you just ended in some charges, and then if you actually, you know, looked inside, you'd realize, no, there are no charges in your theory, that electric field just line just kept on going.
That's right. The projection.
Yeah,
that's it, right.
If but you're saying HA times HB.
Oh, I see. Yes. No, you're right. Yeah. HA times HB, you're right, has charges that are sort of confined to this entangling surface. It's kind of like a membrane. Paradigm,
it's
right? where you take away the other side.
The problem is you have like negative degrees of freedom, and you're canceling them by adding positive degrees of freedom, so you get the right number. The Gauss-like constraint means you have a deficit in the number of degrees of freedom compared to in the tensor product. So you can add degrees of freedom, and then you get just the right number to factorize.
That's right. That's basically it.
Look at the entanglement of those new degrees of freedom with all the other degrees. With the original degrees of freedom? I mean, you now don't have a bipartite.
No, you do. Now by
he does.
Adding
he
them,
did it
you
before.
Do.
Now he does.
You add just enough so that you now do have a bipartite.
Yeah, but you didn't before.
But you didn't before, yeah.
Right. So we'll see how that sort of I mean, there is sort of a subtraction of degrees of freedom that goes on, which is the next thing after I tell you what's sort of special about these states. What's special about the states that live in this smaller space is that if you trace out B, there's one degree of freedom that is already determined by the state of B. When you trace it out, it can no longer be in a coherent superposition. It has to be mixed. So your density so I'll define rho A to be trace of B psi. And then it turns out that that's going to have some direct sum form. So it's a direct sum over all E perps of the probability of having that given E perp times a density matrix within each sector. So it's something like schematically, it's some block diagonal thing. So we have effectively super selection sectors labeled by these charges. Okay. Right. And now the entropy. Breaks up into two terms. One of them is the classical entropy of the electric fields on the boundary. And then the other one is just the expectation value of the von Neumann entropy of each of these density matrices.
So I think this is really the same formula that Horacio would have written down for his electric center.
He did write down a formula like this, but he also said that his algebras were different in the case that you considered multiply connected regions. That the Hilberts, so there's a question of intersection of regions versus intersection of algebras. Yeah. It's his definition.
If it's some very subtle
differentiation, there is a very I see. But for some ordinary reason, region, this would be the same. Yeah. I think,
right? That's right. But one of the weird things that he pointed out, and I hadn't really appreciated before his talk, is that that other definition doesn't satisfy strong subadditivity, which surprised me.
I think it does most of the time.
Right, it's this most of the time thing. This does all of the time. So I think that one satisfies strong subadditivity when it agrees with this one. I mean, this manifestly does, because you just go into a bigger Hilbert space and it's the usual thing.
Yeah.
Can you say again what S of rho on the right here?
This. Yeah, so this is minus trace, the usual von Neumann entropy of the density matrix, which I call rho of E perp, which is these blocks here. So so for each E perp.
You're summing over those blocks?
So each of these blocks is a density matrix, which is the probability of having that given E perp times, some density matrix. So this, so there's some, each of these has a fixed set of E perps coming through this these lines, and some arbitrary superposition of all the things that could be going on one side. So the row tells you all that other stuff that's going on along farther away, and this tells you what's happening right at the surface. And this just follows, this is just the entropy of a density matrix of this form. It's just an identity for the von Neumann entropy. But it follows for any gauge invariant state. Okay, good. So now I want to talk about how you would calculate this in a continuum limit. So first of all, so in general there are two terms. So I'm going to call this S edge. So it's associated with the edge modes, which are So each solution you can break up into two pieces. You can first fix a value of E perp, and in this symmetric case that I wanted to consider, where you have a symmetry about your entangling surface, you can just solve for an eigen for the. You can just solve that classical Euclidean problem with these boundary conditions, these E perp boundary conditions, and you can add another piece on top, plus a piece that satisfies E perp equals zero. So you break up your field like that. So there's some edge mode which is associated to the value of E perp on the edge. Because it's a free theory, these two pieces, while it looks like this P of E perp depends on this because it's a free theory, these decouple from each other. So you can actually decouple the edge from the bulk piece. So I'm going to call this bulk. Okay. And I'm going to focus on S edge. So the way that you find S edge is as follows. So I'm going to fix some E perp on my entangling surface. So now I'm going to imagine I'm in the continuum. I'm going to put this surface. So I'm going to give myself just a little bit of room. I'm going to put some regulated surface epsilon, and I'm going to fix at, so right. So this is the r coordinate going this way, and now this will be say some x, x coordinate going the other way. I'm going to fix E perp on here. So some places, it's going to be pointing out. Some places it's going to be coming in. Whatever, okay. I'm going to fix it at r equals epsilon as a regulator. And now I'm just going to solve for standard electrodynamics, where the perpendicular gradient of my scalar potential is equal. Okay. So that's going to give me some, some E throughout this region. And the entropy I'm going to get is going to be by doing the usual thing, 1 minus beta d by d beta log z edge, where this now is the integral, where z edge now is the integral over e perps of e to the minus classical action of that e perp configuration. And what you find is that the configurations do sort of what you expect. So you can break it up mode by mode, and the electric fields just sort of do this, make little loops. And you can calculate the action of one of these loops. Let's not call it S because I have an entropy, I. And the I of u perp goes like, so there's beta e n squared, so this is a mode of e, and 2 lambda n, so this is the eigenvalue of the Laplacian, lambda n, and log epsilon inverse, so this is cut off dependent. Okay. So what we see, so it's a, you know, it's a quadratic expression because it's a free theory. As you raise the temperature, you increase the fluctuations as usual. So there's a beta here that just comes from the periodicity in, of the time coordinate. There's a the lambda, right? So there's a cutoff, so the fluctuations get larger as the surface goes, sort of sinks deeper and deeper. And that reflects the fact that the deeper you, sort of the closer you put this cutoff, the electric fields sort of hug the horizon more and more, get more and more fluctuations. And then this lambda n appears just exactly the, it appears in the denominator rather than in the numerator for this, basically for a similar reason. As you move the sort of these positive and negative e perps closer to each other, these loops get smaller and smaller. They hug closer to the to this entangling surface and pick up less Euclidean action. So the point is that this gives, so when you actually carry out this integral, what you find instead of the usual, so if the usual, in the usual functional determinant, you'd have this thing in the numerator. You do a Gaussian integral in which it's in the denominator. And what you find is that this is minus log z of a scalar in d, in dimension d minus 2.
But well, can I say what?
Yeah.
So p of e perp depends on, oh, are we just doing the case of a half space?
Yeah, right now I'm just doing a half space, but in the paper we talk about it's true under the restriction of this symmetry, so you could do like a de Sitter or something.
But when you did the calculation, you just, maybe I didn't exactly understand, but you didn't sort of know what was going on away from the entangling surface.
Good. So yeah, I didn't do that calculation here. I mean, we did in the paper. So what you have to do is you have to solve this. You have to solve this equation, and indeed, it has a solution that goes outward. Point is that this is to leading order in epsilon. So for small epsilon. So yeah, indeed, if you have some finite epsilon, then these things are going to sort of go outward and probe the whole, you know, probe the space-time geometry out to some distance. But the point is that when epsilon is small, the leading order piece of the solution is, I mean, the solutions tend to stay close to the entangling surface.
So typically, the charge density along the entangling surface is close to zero as epsilon goes to zero.
The charge
I mean, you have a charge density along the entangling surface. That's E perp.
Right? Yeah.
Let's call that a charge. So
it's... its fluctuations are getting larger as you shrink the surface.
Its fluctuations are getting larger. So it doesn't... I see.
It's weird. It's the opposite of... it's sort of the opposite of what you would expect.
So is there some sense in which as epsilon goes to zero, you stop caring what the geometry of A is? That's what I understand. Why does this calculation localize onto the entangling surface? From the top line, it doesn't seem like it would, but... because P of E perp actually depends on all of A.
It does. No, that's a good question.
The potential calculating the fields and finding the static electromagnet.
Oh yes, yeah, so, right. Sorry. So there's one component that does care. If you had like a closed horizon or something. On a circle, yeah. Then there'd be one sort of overall E perp, which would be like the integral of the whole, you know, through the whole surface, which determines the total charge. Yeah. And that doesn't, that sort of doesn't decay. You know, that is measurable sort of at that's measurable at infinity. So there's one zero mode component that doesn't decay. But everything else in the limit that you take epsilon zero to zero does. And I guess the interpretation of that is just that the electric field fluctuations grow and grow as you take the your cutoff away. So the fluctuations of the electric field are dominated by the sort of local geometry of the surface.
So is this because the equations are linear? I mean, if it's non-linear, then
That's right. So I used crucially that the equations are linear. So I used it in order to I think in general you could fix this. There are more conceptual issues in the non-abelian case, but I think in general you could fix this. If you fix this electric field, you still have an analog of this formula. You can fix each electric field, but now, and you can actually. I mean, I think you could just find the minimum of, the Euclidean action. What's going to change though is that the fluctuations about that configuration are going to depend on which one you had. So now you have to sort of recalculate this for each possible configuration, and that enters. Right. And no doubt this actually solving is harder. So I have that's the simplification that being free advised
to. To get to this formula for I, the starting point is what? The free electromagnetic action?
Yeah, right. So good. Yeah, so this is I of E perb is just the integral over the region of space with r greater than epsilon of 1 half e squared. It's just, where e is grad phi. It's just the ordinary electromagnetic energy of the classical solution. So
why is it blowing up? Is that epsilon goes to z?
Good. So the reason that it's blowing up So here's an epsilon. I'm going to draw a smaller epsilon here. Or maybe I should draw a bigger one. Well, I'll draw a smaller one. All right. So here's a slightly smaller epsilon, and now my loops of the electric field, they would like to be.
Loops of electric field. I mean, I'm solving some differential equation.
I'm just drawing the electric. I'm choosing my E to be of the form grad phi, and I'm drawing the electric field lines. That's all this is. Just an illustration. It is a solution to some differential equation. That's what I actually did. I'm just trying to illustrate it here with the electric field lines to give some intuition for Will's question of why the fluctuations behave in this way. And the answer is that basically you're trying to minimize what's near the surface is a boost energy. You're trying to minimize the boost energy. That's the thing. These configurations are trying to minimize their boost energy, and so if they want to sort of stay as close to the surface as possible, but they're not allowed to just sort of to sit directly on the surface. They have to actually poke out at this point. So they want to turn around sort of as quickly as possible, and if these are sort of closer, they're able to turn around faster. You just sort of scale this picture down. Is the way it works, sort of close up. And so, right. And this has a smaller, good. So this has a smaller, okay. Yeah, maybe I should write this up. So smaller epsilon, okay, leads to a smaller boost energy, which leads to a smaller action, which leads to a larger, which leads to larger fluctuations of the field, which means larger S. So, in the usual case, if you take a mode and you put it sort of more and more in the UV, its fluctuations are supposed to decrease usually, right? Here, if you take this configuration of charges and you make it more UV, its fluctuations grow. And that's the reason precisely for this minus sign. Right.
So how does this depend on the original state?
How does
this for a specific psi?
This is a very specific psi. Sorry. when you do this calculation, the state that you're using is this, the vacuum state delivered to you by the Euclidean path integral. So it's really, it's for vacuum state.
Yeah, but
or in really, de Sitter, it would be, pardon?
I mean, it's some local thing. So unless, as long as you have any low energy state, it's going to be the same. Right? This is the divergent part.
Yeah, so right, near this surface, yeah, that's exactly right. Every state should look at the vacuum, you know, like the vacuum on sort of short enough scales.
Yeah, we also showed the finite piece ends up agreeing.
Right, good. Yeah, so right now I've just shown divergences. If you want to know, we actually matched the... So right. So this calculation agrees with this one here to leading order, but we indeed calculated all the subleading pieces and matched those as well. And if you really want to hear about that, that's why we have a longer paper.
Can I ask a question?
So yeah.
Somehow the conceptual mystery was this minus sign.
I think the whole thing was a conceptual mystery. I mean, there were papers written, and I wrote one of them saying, you know, what on earth is this thing, and trying to interpret it in different ways.
The minus sign is just a symptom of the fact that nobody knew how to interpret this as an actual statistical term involving the actual degrees of freedom of something.
Okay, so my question is, so, you know, in like, topological entanglement entropy of like Kitaev models, mm-hmm. you know, you have this minus sign. Of course, it's finite, so the whole thing is still positive because you have a positive area term. But that's essentially due to the Gauss law. You know, you have some global Gauss law. I mean, is this essentially that you have some deficit in entanglement? Because there's fewer degrees of freedom than you thought there were because of the Gauss law. It's acting locally, so it's still proportional to the area, unlike in the topological case. But
I think that's right. I mean, if you can repeat this exact way of doing things in the toric code, you know, in this Kitaev model. And indeed, what you find is in that case, you get only this term. There's no bulk stuff. It's just the boundary piece, and it is and it's one that sort of one extra constraint that gives you the negative one here. But here, one thing that's different though is that, which is the last thing I realize I've taken more time than I expected. Right. So here you don't just have a constant. In fact, you can have a divergent piece as well. And that's the
so
that's
are the P's,
you can have a log divergence.
So I mean, normally that's an entropy of the distribution. You have P's.
Yes,
so it would be positive by definition. But
it is, yes, right, good.
How is that possible?
It is. It's manifestly positive, regulated on the lattice. That's right.
I see.
Then you can take take a continuum limit of that, and just write that down as a formal expression. So it looks like some functional determinant with some factors that we worked out. And then you could take that expression and regulate it by some other means. If you were to regulate it by the heat kernel, you get Cabot's negative divergent thing.
So there are no P's anymore.
That's right. There are no P's. You take a continuum limit of it, and it becomes kind of a you know, integral rho log rho or something.
It's because the heat curve becomes a continuous variable. So it's more like taking a classical entropy of a classical data space with like the log of the volume.
But when you go from a sum p log p and you take a continuum limit going to a rho log rho, there's some overall constant that you have that you subtract sort of each mode. And so that, you know, if you go from one description to the other, that changes the sum. And it turns out that the way that the heat kernel winds up regulating this thing is to make the UV degrees of freedom always count as zero. Maybe I shouldn't explain it. But basically, the way that it subtracts things off, because it'll always give positive answers if your fluctuations are increasing towards the UV. If your fluctuations are decreasing toward, if your fluctuations are decreasing toward the UV, the heat kernel gives you a positive answer. If, as in this case, they're actually increasing toward the UV, it turns out that it gives you a negative answer. But I don't think there's any reason to trust the sign of that leading heat kernel regulating divergence. It's not really a, yeah. So I think that's one of the surpluses, is that it's actually not you shouldn't worry too much about the sign in the first place. It's not really a meaningful thing.
But it does come out negative in the end. So this extra term dominates the positive scale.
If regulated by the heat kernel regulator.
So yes. I guess I always want to ask, is there a regulator that's reasonable that you can invent that would give you a positive value that sort of, quote, makes sense, unquote, in the sense of
a lattice? That's my best guess. I mean, you want something that would be sort of work in the continuum as well.
Well, it turns out it's positive if you use a hard momentum cutoff instead.
Yeah,
it's the shenanigans of the heat kernel and that flipping the sun.
Okay. You guys are my heroes. You got rid of that minus sign.
All right, it's always good to make your advisor proud. All right, so just one last thing, and that is hopefully quick, which is that this actually resolves this log divergence puzzle as well. If you take minus, we have basically minus one scalar on the entangling surface. So now if we consider a sphere, the scalar, so the entangling surface is always two dimensions lower than the full spacetime. So the universal, your universal piece, which is a log divergence in even dimensions or a constant in odd dimensions, in d minus two dimensions, you'll have the same type of universal term. You'll have a log in even dimensions and a constant in odd dimensions. So this edge piece actually does contribute to the universal terms. So here we have a minus one scalar degree of freedom, and that log divergence is well known. Okay, and it's 1/3. And if you add that to this thermodynamic entropy, if you this
divided,
which is the bulk, pardon?
15 divided by 45.
Exactly. There you go. What you find agreement again with the anomaly. Good. All right, so yeah, so just to summarize, I think that these contact interactions are really a statistical, they really are encoding something about the entanglement entropy. They're not just some extra thing. And they're a statistical entropy of degrees of freedom that exist within the theory that are these edge modes.
So sorry, so you're saying when you do it on H3 times R, you're doing wrong calculation because you missed the contact term because you've sent it to infinity?
Yeah, exactly. So there are a few different ways that people, two different ways that people have done this calculation. One is on H3 cross R, and what you do is you calculate the entropy density and you integrate it up to some cutoff surface. But you don't include any piece that lives on the boundary. So you'd miss anything like this. The other thing that you can do is you can, in this De Sitter calculation, what you do there is you integrate up the first, you use the first law and you integrate it up from zero temperature. But that's problematic when you have these modes that live right on the surface, because there's an issue of the order of limits between taking the temperature to zero and the continuum limit. It's true that at any finite cutoff, if you take the temperature to zero, then the entropy will go to zero. But if you're in the continuum, it doesn't work that way. So if you actually you'd actually still have a continuum of modes for any temperature. So you miss out the sort of zero temperature piece of the entropy.
So the top one is the right answer.
Yeah. So this
is
the right
answer. Just wrong.
Yeah. It's only part of the answer, I would say. Good. So to be generous, I'd say it's a correct calculation of this term. Okay. Good. So yeah. And I also think that this is evidence that this is the right definition of entropy that we should be using. That it's the one that is consistent with these Euclidean methods that are closely related to ideas of black hole thermodynamics. So this is the thing that would agree with the renormalization of Newton's constant and with a number of calculations that have been done in that context. Or something like, if you have something like Ryu Takenagi, which is based on the replica trick, which is the sort of extension of this Euclidean method, then What we've shown, at least in this case, is that it's calculating this definition of the entropy. So in some sense, this is the, I think this is the right one. Okay. So let me stop there since I've gone for a long time.
I guess these are supposed to go, well, first I should say, I guess I'm in charge, and the, since Tarun and Roger aren't here, and I think these are supposed to go an hour and 15 minutes, and we started 5 minutes late.
Okay.
Do you think so you can summarize?
I planned only a very short 5 to 10 minute time presentation.
Good.
It's just a sort of here there be dragons for the gravitons.
Okay.
It's basically just a list of issues.
Okay.
It's nothing like Yeah. So, I guess this one's is it still on? Okay, so I just wanted to say a little bit about the pitfalls of trying to extend this sort of thing to gravity, with just a few of the issues. So most of what I'm going to say is in the appendix. Of this paper, with my collaborators and that's me, and I'm forbidden to discuss this paper itself, but we proved something interesting about the entanglement entropy that you should read about. We proved for free fields and conjectures more broadly something about its second derivative, but I'm forbidden to talk about. Instead, I'm talking about the appendix, where we talked about the issues with renormalizing the entanglement entropy, and in particular, the issue with gravitons. So we found that for the case, in the case of gravitons, when people worked out these heat kernel coefficients, they also found a negative answer for the leading order divergence. In fact, that's what gets asymptotic safety people excited, because it means pure GR anti-screens Newton's constants, and then they think maybe there's a fixed point. But leaving that aside, you'd like to understand the entanglement entropy of gravitons, even, you know, linearized, you know, linearized spin 2 field. You could ask, can we take a region, so we have some, you know, metric, classical metric plus a perturbation, and we might ask, can we calculate the entanglement entropy of that? Well, what are the issues that pop up? So one, which is sort of obvious from Will's talk, is that we expect, most likely, that because there's gravitational constraints, there should also be edge modes from the gravitational constraints. And presumably this also explains this weird negative contribution in the case of gravitons. But there's more gravitational constraints. We have the diffeomorphism constraints. So it should at the very least be more complicated with more indices and so on version of this story. But that's not the only problem. There's a second issue, which is that gravitons, you'd worry that gravitons move the entangling surface around. So here, you could say, since gravitons are fluctuations in the metric, you could worry that you pick this region here, that because gravitons change the metric, that you could wonder, well, isn't that going to make it a little fuzzy, what exactly we mean by this region? So you could say, we need to covariance definition of the entangling surface E, we could call it, in general, for what we mean when we start perturbing the metric. Because if we don't, if we just specify its coordinate location and then turn on a metric fluctuation, then we could worry that it's going to not be calculating something gauge invariant. Now,
if you pick like to be an extremal surface or something, then it's you know there's just some gauge where it doesn't.
Right. So there's some, you can pick some gauge of an extremal surface or horizon or concretely tie it down. Then that answer should be fine. Now, in fact, I think this is probably not actually a problem. This is not actually a problem. You might think it is if you're just interested in the leading order loop contribution to the entropy. Because if we write out this metric as a classical piece, so this is like an H bar G expansion, there's a classical piece plus there's a first order piece coming from the gravitational fields of the gravitational field sourced by matter fields. There's actually an order 1/2 piece, so like square root of H bar G, coming from gravitons, coming from the fact that the amplitude of the energy of a gravitational wave is like the amplitude squared. So the energy of a graviton is like h bar omega. You expect something that goes like square root of h bar to come in here. So I think if you just put in a cutoff here, if you just put in some cutoff epsilon that is much larger than the Planck scale, and you're just interested in the sort of one-loop contribution to the entanglement entropy, that will be of order unity. So you'll have an order unity piece. And then if you calculate how much does this push around the surface by, it'll push around the surface by this order square root of h bar amount. So that's plus an order square root of h bar piece. And this is subleading compared to this. So I believe if you just want to play that game, you're OK. If you wanted to calculate something slightly different, which is like the black hole entropy or the what they call the generalized entropy, where you calculate where you're sort of trying to include the quantum gravity stuff we think is in the black hole thermodynamics, we have an area law piece like A over 4GH plus the entanglement entropy of this, and you think that this is the entanglement entropy maybe coming from really close to Planckian stuff, and you take this whole thing and you calculate its fluctuation, then you'll find that because there's a GH bar in the denominator, you'll run into horrible problems. But this definition of the entangling surface is going to start mattering a lot. Even in the case of Faulkner, Lukowitz, and Malvicena, where they calculated this bulk entanglement entropy in ADS-CFT, they only had a term, they didn't discuss gravitons explicitly. They had a matter contribution like this, GAB to the 1. And that was okay because they chose their E to be extremal. And the first order variation of extremal surface doesn't change the area. But for gravitons, even an extremal surface is not good enough, and you'll have to worry about this issue. Okay, the third problem is that gravitons are not defined off-shelf. What I mean by that is if we linearize the spin 2 equations of motion, it turns out the gauge symmetries don't close. I think that's the problem. Unless we start on a background manifold that involves, that has the traceless part of the Ricci tensor equal to 0. So that means the usual way you do this kind of calculation, if you do a replica trick type thing, you work out your divergences in from the heat kernel or something. You have terms like R, and then at the quadratic order, you have things like R squared, RAB squared, CAB, the Weyl squared, and box R or something, and keep going. These coefficients end up telling you what the various divergences of the entanglement entropy are. And if this equation is satisfied, if this equation has to be satisfied on your background to even talk about the fluctuations, some of these coefficients are not even well defined. essentially, when I do this replicate trick, since I'm taking beta not equal to 2 pi, there's like some sort of membrane that we're going off shell. You could think of it as being sourced maybe by some type of membrane, but then, and throw it, think of it as a physical membrane, but then my entanglement entry might include a contribution of a fluctuation of this membrane that isn't really physical. So that's another thing to worry about. And the fourth and final thing to worry about is that nobody, even so, nobody can agree on what numbers these are. So the people have calculated these things by heat kernel coefficients, and the calculations are tough enough, and there's enough conceptual difficulties that even when they are in harmonic gauge and just using the heat kernel, and so you think everything could agree, they end up with different results. For example, for this coefficient, there's a paper by Persayev and Neal, number 97, that ends up disagreeing with another calculation by Soladukin in 11 and 15. And Persayev and Neal even found a weird thing where the beta, as you take the limit as beta goes to 2 pi, it doesn't even agree with the case of beta equals to 2 pi. That's terrible blackboard stuff. I'm going quickly here. And in this r squared term, so people worked out these terms at quadratic curvature gravity. There's a bunch of mistakes in the literature. What we found, Will and I actually sorted through this carefully. If you want this r squared term, what you really want to look at is Christensen and Duff, 80, who worked it out in detail. There's the majority of papers, like the one they wrote the year before, or if you just look it up in Birrell and Davies, or Vasilevic, the heat kernel, user's manual, they made a variety of mistakes that make this coefficient wrong. So if you want to...
there's one paper that has the right...
Of the papers we've looked at, there's just one that has it right. So no two papers agree except those that are wrong.
80 means 1980?
1980.
Yes. I have no idea people were calculating these things like, as opposed to 1880
or 2080.
I believe it might be number 80 on some list.
No. Okay. So this is the Here There Be Dragons list for trying to extend this to gravitons. Will and Laurent have a paper which will probably be out by 2080, where they describe the sort of analog of these edge modes for the gravitational field classically. It would be interesting to see whether that actually also resolves the similar term that comes up there. But unfortunately, there's all these other conceptual issues and technical problems to work through. So if any of you are interested in entanglement entropy of gravitons, you have your work cut out for you.
Have you given up?
No. Hard enough, you guys should all feel free to do it, and we're not trying to, you know, pour the problem.
That could probably be a little